Hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini. Thank you ever so much for coming back to the Go See Talk podcast experience. Oh, man, it's getting warmer out there. Is it not? Global warming, just normal seasons, whatever it is. What's a good way to keep out of the heat? Watching series after series and binging. So whether you throw Hacks on, The Queen's Gambit, Department Q, one thing is for sure, you're going to be entertained and your eardrums are going to love it. So we are speaking to the man behind three of those shows amongst a myriad of others. Carlos Rafael Riviera is the I would say composer of the highest merit, because when you work on something like Queen's Gambit, it's tough to make chess cool, but holy cow, he is a Fonzie. Little Pulp Fiction reference,
nice,
everybody.
Nice.
Well, Carlos, thank you so much for being on the show. How are things in your world?
Oh, man, it's nice to talk to you, Mark. So far, so good, and just as hot as you said, because I'm in Miami, so it's kind of boiling, and we're just in June, so...
Mm-hmm.
Tomorrow's the longest day of the year, and so we are meant to feel it here in Miami. So yes.
Okay. Are you praying for a hurricane or something like that? It's just something to break the weather.
No, definitely we don't pray for that, because then that comes true. We stay away. That's our we're lucky as opposed to the West Coast, where the West Coast gets the non-alert earthquake or tremors, right? And but in California, but in Miami, we get the hurricanes and we get some days ahead. And so we get to flee. Last time we kind of left my house was, I forget what the hurricane was, but it coincided with the opening of one of the Star Wars rides, Rise of the Empire. I forget what it's called, but in Orlando and Disney. And the joke they had was that because we went to Orlando to kind of stay there and safe from Miami. And the hurricane literally went up all along the way through Miami straight and landed in Orlando. It ended there. And so the joke was that the hurricane heard that the Star Wars Rise of the Resistance was opening. So it wanted to go. That was a joke. But hurricanes are a very, very, very scary thing here for us. But it's what we deal with on the annual between now and through probably late September, October. And then we're okay. So, but yeah, long answer to your question. Sorry.
No, it's good. I'm long-winded. Please welcome. I welcome the verbose lot out there. So, you know, in a weird way, it's kind of like, you know, how people are saying, oh, it's so insensitive to use Native American names for colleges and professional ball players. Like, why is the University of Miami still have Hurricane as their name? Like, it's a crane, right? Why don't they just call it the Cranes or Herons or something?
You know, it's funny, Hurricane. I mean, it was founded upon the event of a hurricane. The year they were supposed to open a hurricane, I forgot the name of that one, came and destroyed campus. So they weren't really officially opened. It's been 100. We just celebrated our centennial at the Frost School. I mean, at the University of Miami School of Music was one of the first ones open as well. And but a hurricane did come and destroy it. And so I think they just kind of, you know, acknowledged the power.
Yeah, study at University of Miami. We will give you the tools to take on the world and lay cities to waste. So,
sure.
Well, let's go back into you know, you're clearly not 100 years old, but let's go back into your founding moments.
It.
You know, your formative years. What about music got you so invested and set you off on this trajectory?
I guess. I think I was just always attuned to music in the sense that how it affected me before I ever thought I'd be making it or being involved in it. I don't think I started taking piano lessons when I was six, and then we stopped because I left. I was living in Guatemala and I had my first recital, you know, my sister played really well, then my brother and then myself. And so I had my little Hammond's piano, little things, you know, a wigwam or whatever those pieces were that you had to play recitals. And then we moved to Costa Rica. And then we stopped, and then we moved to Panama, and I started taking guitar lessons because my dad wanted to learn how to sing. He was a great singer. He passed away a few years ago, but he was a fantastic singer. Like, none of us have inherited that, unfortunately, but definitely had the gift of a voice and a natural one. And so he wanted to take guitar lessons to kind of accompany himself, but he never practiced. Like most adults, it's very hard for adults to kind of take on something new, you know, and take on a skill set. And just because of lifetime work, God knows what, now that I'm one of them, you know. But then my brother and I took lessons, but then I kept playing classical guitar. I kept practicing. My brother, we moved back to Costa Rica. My brother joined a rock band. And because I was 4 years younger, I wasn't cool enough to be in the band, right? I would just go to the practice and watch them. I don't even, what was your question? Lord Almighty.
What got you into music?
Oh
No, but
yeah,
keep
well
going.
there
This
you
is
go.
great. You're...
Yeah, that was sort of it.
Hold on, I'm gonna pack a lunch and join you on this just journey.
Sorry, I'm gonna fast forward, man. I was getting bored and it's my story. I basically started playing guitar and taking lessons that way. And then it wasn't until we moved to Miami when I was about 14 that when you move to a new country, I usually tended to move and land in the middle of a school year. So it was like January, it's like third week of January. Hey, everybody, here's Carlos. It was like, ugh, having to adapt to that social aspect of it, from fourth grade, sixth grade, eighth grade, and then eighth grade again when I moved to Miami. And then it was because of the language barrier. My English wasn't good. So they kind of put me back, because so I could catch up. And I remember just like, I'd get home and I just play guitar because I had nobody to talk to, no social life whatsoever. But it really helped because I would be listening to all these rock bands and all this great music from that time. I think still to a certain degree, but I would listen to Ozzy Osbourne and all these rock bands from the time and Journey. And so I learned all that music and that kind of got me going. As a performer, as a writer, not as a writer, it started to happen after. So, yeah, that's kind of the start of it, I guess.
When you say learned, you mean self-taught? You just started to teach yourself Crazy Train or something?
Yes, man. I, as a matter of fact, you mentioned Crazy Train, so I'll go even with Randy Rhoads. Randy Rhoads was the guitarist of Ozzy Osbourne and Blizzard of Oz. My brother came back from a retreat, a Christian retreat, and he came back and he had a tape of Ozzy Osbourne. So I don't know how that works out. But at the time he came back and he played that and he had, it was Blizzard of Oz and it was Revelation to Mother Earth. And when I heard that, I was moved. Like I remember at the end of the song, I was smiling from ear to ear. And I remember thinking, well, when I, if the day I can play that guitar solo, I'll be done as a musician. I'll be the best, blah, blah, blah. And then the day actually did come. Eventually, like by the time I moved to Miami, I was learning everything by ear. And like I'd put the move the needle back on the record and play it back. And then I had an audio cassette player, whatever. So I would record myself playing my guitar with the record and study the tape, if you will, and hear all the mistakes I was making. And that's how I developed my ear. And then the day eventually came, I was maybe about 15 or 16 where I could play that solo. I mean, I can say this now because now I suck, but back then I was really good on the electric guitar. Like I was a really good guitar player. But the older I get, the better I used to be, And so I ended up really, really realizing the moment I learned that solo that it, that man, but how did he write it? How did he come up with that? And that's when the curiosity began. To become more of a writer. And I started writing songs. I eventually joined my brother in a rock band because now I was older, and it was cool enough or whatever for him. And then we started writing songs together and we sounded like the bands we loved. We sounded like Rush and Journey and all the bands of the time that we kind of really, really loved. And Boston, by the way, I love that band. And we started playing covers at parties. We started making money as a cover band. And then, my brother eventually got married and I moved away and started studying. I went to study music in Los Angeles. I had studied in Miami, but I really took it seriously when I moved to LA.
Well, aside from teaching yourself and, you took lessons before that point, who in your studies has been probably your beacon, like the one person you're so glad to meet because after that things changed, or have things just been a constant stepping stone to
It's
get
kind
where
of
you are?
it's a bit of both. I mean, the thing you would say, I mean, for this world that's gotten me the privilege to get to talk to you and other folks about what I do is Randy Newman was my mentor through USC.
Oh, no way.
That was crazy. Yeah, no, the fact is I had at that time had become a massive fan before I even knew that was going to happen. Like I had fallen into the not only the composer for all those fantastic films, The Natural, Toy Story 2, and all those things that he had done at the time. But it was the fact that I had discovered Randy Newman, the songwriter, and not just of the songs people know, like I Love LA, Short People, but Nilsson Sings Newman and songs Dayton, Ohio, and all the Love Story, God knows, like all these fantastic songs that he had done. And that's when I got magically paired with him through by being at USC, getting my doctoral. Because I had been in a rock band and done that, and I was doing classical. They paired me with him because he was like a songwriter and a composer, and there was this mentorship program they had with people from the board at USC, and I was paired with him for that reason. I had obviously applied to it, but I never thought I'd get it. But there I was, and that's one very important step, because he really taught me a lot about how, you know, how to be in a room when you're working with the people and understand that that's a service industry is what we do. We serve the vision of somebody else, even though it's Randy Newman, man. You know what I mean? But Randy is working for those directors, and having that mindset early on really has helped me from losing many jobs, I think. And then on the other side, every teacher I had at USC, it was Stephen Harkey and Donald Crockett. Donald Crockett was like super important in my life. You know, I got a record deal while I was at USC, and I said, I met with him and I said, hey, how do I deal with this? I have a record deal, but I'm not done with my master's. He goes, Carlos, you're young once, you know, why don't you go get this record, do this thing, and school's not going anywhere. So I took a leave of absence because of him. And wow. When that dream of the rock and roll thing died, after the record deal fell through, and everything kind of like went 2 or 3 years of this, almost what you would call VH1 Behind the Music without anybody finding out about it or it getting filmed. And it came back, and he was there, and he said, have you thought of finishing your degree? I was like, nope. And he goes, you should finish your degree. And so he was a true mentor for me in that way. In Miami, it was Orlando Garcia. And he was a very difficult composition teacher who challenged me and really made me understand that I had to, that I wasn't just writing music. I was trying to say something. And that was great for me. Every teacher I think I've had has had, you know, specific influence in one way or another, one aspect or another.
Well, I think that's good too. Cause you can never be done with schooling. I mean, even somebody like Martin Scorsese is still learning stuff. Cause he says, once I know everything, I'll stop making movies, but you know, you can keep absorbing and changing. Oh, yeah. But that's really cool. So was the mentorship, was it a one-on-one, or were there other people assigned to Randy?
I think a few people after the following year, someone else got assigned in the following year, but we kind of stayed connected. That's the crazy thing. It's like he basically sent me an email, you know, I'm pleased to meet, you know, maybe come over to my place. And I was like, are you kidding me? So I went to see him at his house, and then in his studio in the back where he works. And he would just play music for me, and we'd just talk. And then we just got along. And that was like incredible to me. He would also send me just randomly call, say, hey, I'm going to a session now. And I went to see like the dub mix for The Leatherheads, a movie with George Clooney. That George Clooney directed. I was there for The Princess and the Frog, the recording sessions.
Nice.
And I mean, it was crazy to be there, but also to watch him work with directors. That's where I'm calling back to when I talk about understanding how to behave in a room, because I remember sitting there and I was like, oh my God, I was like a fly on the wall. Like I couldn't believe I was there. And then all of a sudden, like the directors, there were two of them for that movie. And Randy, they're playing back one of the songs, you know, down in New Orleans, or they're recording, they're tracking the song. And then one of the directors says, you know, I'm not sure about the drum thing there. And I'm like, dude, that's Randy Newman. You can't say that to Randy. You know, in my mind, I'm like, what are you doing? And Randy turned around and he was like, yeah, I think we can change this. Give me a second. Let me see if I can. And he starts talking to the music. And I was like, wait, oh, dude, he's working for them. Like it clicked. And had I not seen that, I think I would have probably not worked. Because, you know, when you walk in, you kind of think, oh, I'm doing the music and the music's important. No, it's an aspect of the whole storytelling process. And understanding that's really important for people who are starting to get into this. If they're anybody's listening, that's the secret, I think, is to know your place and know that you're contributing something. And there's always a better version, you know, that you can write to what they need, because it's a collaborative process. It's not just you bringing music, you know?
Yeah. You know, I'm so glad you said that. I remember I've spoken to Harry Gregson Williams a number of times, but I think in this most recent interview, he was telling me about his times working with watching Hans work with Tony Scott and just having that dialogue. And, you know, at the end of the day, there's something I tend to say this a lot, because I think this is the most interesting mindset. Because without me being musical, hearing Marco Beltrami say, film music is not pure music. You know, it's not something that you would write on your own. It's in service of it. So what you're saying is like, this is all speaking towards, you're contributing to this, this greater picture, greater vision. So no, I'm so glad you mentioned that.
Truth. And no different than a costume designer or a set designer. Do you think, you know, honestly, a great costume designer that they hire, who's worked on all these other films, comes and works for the director, and the director shows up with a jacket for the character, and the director says, I don't like it. That costume designer, if they're working, they're bound to say, what do you think could be different? They're like, oh, whatever. He goes, well, let me see if I can get you a couple more options. That's collaborative. But the ego, one would think, is it, that the costume designer would present the jacket and the director says, I don't like it. And the costume designer is like, but you understand, I went through three different bins. I did research on the history of this, and this character is really assigned to this. That's not the place. The conversation should happen if the director asks. But I think it's truly more like we're all serving the same thing. And the point I'm trying to make is that our ego for being composers should be no bigger than the costume designers or the set designers or anybody who's doing this, because we're all trying to tell a story and everyone is ideally bringing their A game to help this thing become great, you know? So, yeah.
So when you are at the music school in Miami, is that the first lesson you teach the students? Like what is the prerequisite for sort of, oh, sorry, first day of class for you? It's like, well, this is not your baby. It is, but it's not really your baby, you know?
No. Yeah. Frost School, I think, I chair the media scoring and production department, and we have a fantastic team of faculty. We have Camilo Rodriguez running the graduate program, Pauli Herman running the undergrad, and I mean, sorry, Randy Barlow running the undergrad, and Pauli helps us teach, and he's amazing as well. We have, our main thing is to bring the real world to the academic world, and we're really teaching students what happens in the line. This is not something that happened 10 years ago or 15 years ago, and back in my day kind of teaching. This is like right now. This is what's happening now because we're all working in one way or another in this industry. And trying to bring best practices to them and or best failures, you know, all the mistakes we make. And so a lot of the conversation, I mean, the first project they have, a lot of them are very talented because, you know, in order to get into the school, aside from our program, they just have to be very good at what they do, is that we have the first project I usually give them is to write to timing notes, which says door closes at 10 seconds, door opens at 15 seconds, bad guy comes in at 17 seconds, person runs at 20. And you have to write with no picture. You have to write to that because you're telling a story in time. That is what you're doing. And you're going to do it with piano, maybe fake piano or whatever, but you're not going to do it with all the libraries that you're so used to using. By library, I mean sound libraries. We have a lot of access to things that sound like an oboe, things that sound like strings, things that sound like big percussion and bombastic stuff. And a lot of composers tend to lean on those rather than the raw aspect of what storytelling musically is. And so that first project's a real, real challenge, I think. And it's good because it says, this is what it's like, this is what it's about. And then, you know, once you build on that, then you bring other practices like understanding what temp music is. And tent music is something that we all have to understand and reckon with and get good at, like understanding what the style is, how to imitate it, how to get close to it, but not get in trouble, you know, legally, because that is part of the way in which movies are made. You know, you need to use temporary music in order to screen it for an audience that's going to be a test audience, that's going to give a great score to the production company, who's going to then make changes to the movie if they need to or not, because at the end of the day, it is a product. It is a thing that is being sold and marketed to for an audience to consume. And then when all the elements add up, you ideally get a situation where you one and one is three, and you get those things that people call art, you know. But I'm a very big believer and firm believer in the fact that it's craft first. And if you're good at it, understanding and put the hours in, or sweat equity or whatever you want to use, good things come out of that. I would say a great example is Dune, you know, as a film, like it or not, it's beautiful. It's perfectly made. The craft of every level, from sound design to the acting, to the editing, to the fantastic score of Hans Zimmer's, of course, to every aspect of it is at the top of level. And that's why it's one of those movies that get all that budget. And thankfully, all of that audience, you know, to appreciate it. And so there are moments of art that are born from all that great craftsmanship. That's a long answer. Sorry, dude.
Well, one and one doesn't make three when it comes to the Queen's Gambit. One and one makes 17 or 28. And same when you start talking about Department Q, you know, there is a bad guy. There is a gunshot. He does come in at, you know, 15 seconds and stuff. So I don't know where to begin with Department Q, except for the intro. There's a conciseness to it, and it feels almost like British in the same way that Ted Lasso and Peaky Blinders feel British. So talk about that. Where'd that come from?
Well, not from me, certainly from Scott. And Scott's adaptation, Scott Frank's the writer director, and he adapted it. I think he's had the rights to the books by Jesse Adler Olson for many years and was trying to make it. These are Scandi-noir books. They take place in another place in Scandinavian st story setting, but they were adapted. And I think from his collaboration with Left Banke Pictures producer Rob Bullock, who kind of helped bring it to England. And for the production company, but then the setting became Edinburgh, right? And so that is really born, I think, from Scott's fandom of British dramas and of that kind. He loves the procedurals, and he so Line of Duty, and there's a bunch of shows that he kind of was watching. Sorry, I got to have this sip of coffee,
Refuel. It's,
but it's
I
Cuban and
allow
it's
it.
necessary, sir. And so I think that kind of setting comes from his love of that kind of storytelling and those shows. So that's what made it sort of, from what I've heard him say, is like he loves the idea of using all the tropes, the begrudging, the curmudgeon-y kind of cop, the building of the team, the very weird story and dark story that a case they're trying to solve. But he always loves to play in those sandboxes and see what new can come out of it. Same thing happened when we did Godless, and he was doing all the tropes of a Western. The duel's going to happen at the end. All of these versions, but it's just exciting to play in and kind of come see what something fresh will come in from playing in the sandbox that's familiar. So that's sort of, I think, how Department Q is truly born in his mind, at least.
Well, but that's another thing. Like, he sets the framework
Yes.
for what you're going to contribute. And so, you help take it to the next step, and next thing you know, you've got a fantastic. And the thing I love about the music, I mean, you're really good at creating this sort of distant, anguished sound, whether it's with guitars or piano. I mean, but there's pure magic in the melodies. And then in the last episode, you've got this like overlong sweet symphony. Like, there's when, well, I wrote these two down, where they're following, where Sam's following Haig up the crag. It's like
Yes.
long and progressive. And then when Mark and Akram are walking the Jennings property, it just keeps getting muddier and more like getting invested. So, like, was that Scott's idea? Hey, give me 29 minutes of wall to wall, or did you say, I need, this
Well,
is.
the first thing I will say is that getting to work with Scott is always a privilege beyond my belief. I've been lucky to work with him so long now that we do have a bit of a shorthand in the process. With Scott, there is no temporary music that's ever placed on everything, and that process sort of was born out of, I have to bring up Wiley Stateman, who's a sound designer, and he came up with this back in Godless, the idea of what's called a rolling mix. And what we're doing is we're assembling the story, and the editing starts to come together, where scenes start to become longer scenes, and I end up scoring that without any temporary music as a guide, and he ends up adding the actual sound that's going to be there. Because what usually happens is that there's temporary music and temporary sound all along the lines until after the whole thing is put together. Then we kind of replace our sound and music. And because of that, I get to work very early on what the tone of the story is going to be. So I work with Scott. And what he's really good at, I feel, are the montage sequences and putting all these moments together. Like that sequence that you mentioned of Sam Haig and Lyle, following him up the thing. That was actually a lot of fun for me to do. There's another scene that's the end of episode one, where there's a whole sequence in the ferry that there's no dialogue. It's just music has to hold and tell the story of what's happening as we're starting to see these timelines converge. That was really born out of the process where Scott's sending me, again, I should mention Michelle Tesoro, the great editor. She's worked with him on Queen's Gambit, on Godless, now this. And so I'm working with stuff that is already cool. Like, I'm getting the scenes, they're freaking awesome. So I have to make sure I don't screw it up. My job is more to not screw things up than it is to, well, let me help this scene. No, this is awesome. I remember even going back to the Queen's Gambit, because you mentioned it, that final game when she looks at the ceiling and there's all the chess pieces and this big moment happens. I cried, and I hadn't written any music. It was done. Like, it's like, what do you need me for? It's so good then. So I think that speaks a lot to the process and the level of the folks you get to work with. And in this case, I think that's the truth. So I think it becomes obvious that we need music in this scene. And we, and that goes back to the screenplay, because he'll send me the screenplay before he even shoots. And I'll read the screenplay like you would read a screenplay or a novel. And if you just ask yourself, okay, am I supposed to, this scene could use music, right? Yeah, you start just, that's thought process is what I do. I read the screenplay and I start going, oh, this is going to need music. And so what I'll do is I'll actually make a QuickTime of that scene. And I'll put the words in a QuickTime movie, like, so you can read it and you're reading it. Like, imagine you're reading words, you know, at the beginning of movies, they sometimes tell you stories and put a paragraph. Same thing. I do that, but then I put music to it and send it to him. This is before he shot anything. And he'll be like, no, this is wrong. No, this is not right. This, and then, so we're making a lot of mistakes before he even shoots. And sometimes the music ends up affecting how he shoots or how he makes a scene. So to get to say that to me is kind of a miracle, because it's very unique to my and Scott's specific work. When I work with other directors or showrunners, there's usually not that amount of time. So,
you know, it's fascinating for two reasons. It just shows the sort of dynamic that you have, but it just also shows how everything's different. You know, there's the famous E.T. where John Williams wrote the bike chase, and then Steven edited the movie to his music because he didn't want to change anything. So it's like that, it's, you know, it's not even a respect thing. It's like, what is best for the project and how do you feel about it moving forward? So, you know, you're all throwing spaghetti at the wall, man. I mean,
yeah, I very much am a fan of that concept, where as long as we're understanding that we're not throwing it at each other, you know, I really mean it, because the ego is the one that'll do that. And that's not what it is. I mean, when you have a really good friend, that you, if you go out when you're younger, I don't know, you're young, but like, and I remember going out, you know, and a friend would come and pick me up. He's like, dude, are you really going to wear that shirt? Do you know what I mean? Like, straight up. And,
yeah,
and that is something that's how we talk about it. And I won't, I'm making sure that I'm not telling him that, because I'm working for him. That's another thing. But we do talk in that way, because we're not talking about me. We're talking about it and a thing. You want to go out and look better when you go out with a shirt, right? He's trying to help you, right? So when we talk about a cue working or not working, we're pretty brutal, but it's not about me. It's about the music and how it's collaborating or helping him tell his story. That's huge. That, and knowing that is what I think helped us, I think, along the years.
Well, time for one more question. And I think you being an artist, you have sort of your gut reaction, you know, litmus tests. So it will be instrumental favoritism. Is there something that you find yourself invariably going, I love this, and somehow it's going to find its way into everything I do? Or just like by virtue of trial and error, like, you know what, we keep coming back to the, you know, 8-string bass or so. I don't know, something like
8-string bass, dude. Nice. No, I don't know. I've always thought, and this is before I was even doing film music, when I was just like writing classical stuff or performing arts music, whatever you want to call that. I always thought of music as a hologram. Like when you're writing a piece of music, it's kind of like, in its true state, it's a holographic sound, meaning that if I want to create a melody, I'm going to sing it. And, or if, let's just put it this way, another way, if I write it on the guitar, I'm going to try to play it on the piano to see how it translates to piano. It's the same melody, but how does it sound on piano? How does it sound when I sing it? When I sing it, I actually can't sing it. It's not as malleable as when I played it on the guitar. So maybe I have to break through the one-dimensional view of that sound, of that melody, into two dimensions by playing it on piano and going, oh, those are extra notes. Those aren't part of the melody. The melody is this. And then when I sing it, I try to sing it separate from the piano and the guitar. Oh, it's only these notes. This is the melody. And it translates back beautifully into all of them. Then from all of those points of view, a melody is made and it works best, and it creates it, its true nature is revealed, if you will. And for me, that is like a process that I always go to in making something. And the same thing goes for scoring. I end up writing, I'm not a great pianist at all. I'm okay. I'm serviceable, I think, at best. But I spend a lot of time playing piano to picture, because it's connected to the instrument, you know, to the logic or the DAW that I used to write with. But then I'll also play it on guitar to see if the melody's working, and I'll sing. So, but sometimes I've even used my phone. Like I've talked about this before, but I'll use my phone voice memo, and I'll be looking at picture for the first time, and I'll because it you usually come with a thing called time code. Like it has time code on the top, and it says 01, 02, 03. So I'll be 01, 02 to guide me, and then as the scene starts, I go 01, 02, 03, dun dun dun, dun 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 dun, dun, right? And then I'll grab the voice memo, put it in the computer, line it up to 01, 02, the picture 03, and then I'm hearing dun dun dun, and then I go, okay, it should be bum 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 on the piano. And then the piano goes, yeah, but that should be cello, shouldn't it? And then I replace the sound with a celli, and then it becomes orchestral or a guitar, bum bum bum, or bass. I grab the 8-string bass man, and I go bum bum bum. I'm just kidding. But there
There
it is, finally, I was waiting for it to come through. No, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
That's the exact. So the process is always. There's not one way to do it. That's for sure, and it always depends on the moment and the scene and what's most serviceable for the scenario we're in.
Well, your students are going to learn a lot from you. If it's not just musical theory, it's just your wordsmith, general demeanor and the way you inspire people. You are no hack. Carlos Rafael Riviera, everybody.
Thank you so much, man.
Well, we had a blast chatting with you. So check out everything he's done, from Godless to Department Q to, it's going to take a long time to get through his resume because he does a lot of shows. So, Carlos, thank you so much for your time, and we will catch you next time.
Thanks so much, Mark.